Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 169. First off, a big thank you to those listeners who've been sending me emails. A great deal of useful information has emerged from our discussions, which always improves the quality of this podcast. Especially thanks to John for sending me your book and Dr. Nkosi for the contact in Eswatini. When we left off, episode 168, pressure was being exerted on the Cut River settlement by the new governor, Sir Henry Pottinger. A quick revisit. The Cut River settlement came into being in 1829 after a clash on the eastern border when the authorities of the Cape Colony expelled Amaxhosa from land around the source of the Cut River. To prevent them from reoccupying the area when the soldiers withdrew, the colonial government decided to settle the area with English settlers and Khoikhoi and Bastards. André Stockenstrom, who was then the Commissioner General of the Eastern Districts, wanted to intersperse the two races and give them equal quantities of land. But his superiors insisted on placing the Khoi in the most exposed military positions, then gave the Khoi smaller land grants than the English settlers received. These two groups were going to serve as a breastwork against an exasperated, powerful enemy. In other words, the Amaxhosa, in the most vulnerable and dangerous part of the frontier. Scattered among the dispossessed Khoza had been pockets of the Gonakwa Khoi, clients of the chief Makoma. Some had fled from the Khamtuas and Fish Rivers early in the century to escape the colonists, while others originally belonged to the London Missionary Society institution near Fort Beaufort. After the death of their missionary, they joined the refugees under Makoma, and their headman was Klaas Nuka, son of a respected interpreter for the Khoza chief Nika at the time of the rebellion in 1815 amongst the Boers, known as the Slachtersnek Rebellion. The Gonakwa people were distinguishable from the Khoza as Khoikhoi. Stockenstrom appointed Gonakwa man Andries Botha as their leader, a man who was regarded as a loyal servant of the colonial government. Botha had family who lived further east among the Khoza, and he applied to Stockenstrom for land for this clan. Stockenstrom agreed, and the Botha family received grants along the left bank of the Cut River, near the villages of Balfour, Phillipton, and Buxton. The little village of Buxton lies just west of the town of Hogsback. Stockenstrom divided up the 60 square miles or so and allotted the Khoikhoi into five separate locations. In the first, at the confluence of the Cut and Mankanzana rivers, he settled 70 men from the Somerset and Graaf-Reinet districts. They were led by Christian Groepe, son of a Khoi woman and a German immigrant, formerly the field cornet at Swagers Hoek in Somerset. What is really fascinating is how many types of people lived in this small area, people who differentiated themselves based on their ancestry. The party at the confluence of the Cut and Mankanzana rivers, for example, belonged to that class of mixed-race South Africans known to the colonists as Bastards, and that's what they called themselves. They had adopted Dutch clothing, the religion, technology, the language, and they did not associate themselves with their Khoi heritage. Among them were a few converts to the Wesleyan Society, and they had more than half a dozen wagons, a large number of cows and oxen, and thousands of head of sheep and goats, as well as horses. They farmed successfully and were regarded as fairly well off. In the second and fifth locations, Stockenstrom placed 144 families from the mission stations of Theopolis in the Albany district and Bethelsdorp near Uitenhage. The first arrivals from Theopolis were led by a man named Balchin, who brought ploughs to the settlement, and he was regarded as an excellent farmer. He built irrigation systems to water his fields and was respected by both colonists and the Khoi. The third location was reserved for a party from Enon in Uitenhage, and the fourth for 40 families from various other districts. You know that news travels fast, and by 1830, various families of different Khoisan and Amaxhosa even had arrived to take advantage of the Cut River settlement. One family had travelled for 3 weeks from across the Orange River. They were so excited by the prospect of being allocated their own land. So this original settlement comprised 70 Bastard families, around 230 Khoisan families, and the Gonakwa Khoi under Andries Botha, whose kinship with the Khoza set them apart from their coloured brethren. This is where the diversity of ancestry is so important. For the governor, this was too much information, but for those born and raised on the frontier like Stockenstrom, the differences were noted and taken into account when it came to political machinations. The languages you'd have heard if you leapt aboard your horse and rode about the Cut River settlement were Dutch, turning into Afrikaans by now, Khoi Khoi, Amaxhosa, and a mixture of all of the above. The political organization of each location tended to reflect their background, so the Bethelsdorpers looked for guidance to the London Missionary Society's James Reed, whose wife was a coloured woman and who had settled at the Cut River against the wish of the colonial government. The Theopolis people were already under a captain named Budzak when they arrived, and Budzak had helped the government fight the Amaxhosa in 1819 and received a special silver-tipped staff as official recognition for his leadership at Theopolis. The Inon contingent accepted a retired sergeant from the Cape Corps named Johannes Tromp as their leader. Boerter and Groepe spoke for the Gonaqua and the Bastards. With the exception of Reed, these individuals performed the customary role of Khoi captains. They were men of substance who acted as spokesmen but possessed little judicial power. Boerter did apparently exercise a greater hold over those Gonaqua with Xhosa relations, who saw in him something of the Xhosa-style chief, and therefore regarded him as more relevant, a man with added political authority. 4 years after the creation of the settlement, it had been divided into 640 allotments capable of irrigation with grazing commons attached. The average size of each allotment, known by the Dutch term erf, was slightly over 6 acres. Commonage varied from 2 to 500 acres. Stockenstrom originally wished to make military service a condition of tenure and issued the settlers with government weapons. By settlers, I'm talking about the Khoi. Later officials waived this condition but did not recall the weapons, so this was a case of the Khoi Khoi being trusted to carry and use muskets. And it was a reason why they were crack shots. However, after the frontier war of 1834 and 35, things began to sour between the Khoi Khoi at the Cut River settlement and the English settlers. There were also internal squabbles which didn't help. The Gonaqua disliked the attitude taken by Christian Groepe and his party from the Somerset area. Andries Boerter, who led the Gonaqua Khoi, said, "When we came here, we were told that we were all Hottentots and all equal, but we are not so. There are bastards among us, and we think that they wish to rule over us and make us slaves." Things worsened when the government moved Hermanus Matroos to the settlement, the son of an escaped slave and a Kunukwebe woman who had grown up amongst Amaxhosa and whose Amaxhosa nickname was Khor Kamesh. But he quarrelled with Boerter, then fled to the colony and collected a following of Kunukwebe families and settled near Fort Brown on the Fish River. He and his men then fought for the colony during the War of 1834-5, and the government allotted them 15,000 acres on the Blinkwater River alongside Boerter's Gonaqua. So you can imagine what happened next. The Gonaqua regarded Matroos and his new arrivals as intruders, and they were jealous of the large tract of land these people had been allocated. What is ironic was that the Gonaqua were descended from a mixture of Khoi and Xhosa people in the 17th century, which had retained its Khoi culture, while the Kunukwebe originated in the Gonaqua-Khoi fusion at a later stage, and then adopted Xhosa ways. So they were kind of cousin clans, if you like, but cousins can quibble viciously, and so it was that the Gonaqua and Matroos's Kunukwebe clashed. The Gonaqua usually associated themselves with the colonial coloured population, and this conflict was sharpened when Kunukwebe chief Patu claimed them as part of his people, and when he visited their settlement they appeared to show him great deference. All very confusing. In the period after the Sixth Frontier War and then the Seventh, economic recovery was slow, although the English farmers in the Eastern Cape had increasingly begun to adopt new commercial farming techniques in the 1830s. As you know, wool became more important and new methods of farming were introduced. The problem was, few Cut River coloureds could obtain the vitally important credit needed for capital investments. By the mid-19th century, English and Boer farmers were able to buy some of these new ploughs and other goods on credit, but the Khoi Khoi and Bastard and Kunukwebe were excluded from the credit deals. The announcement they would not be allowed credit exchanges gave immediate and bitter offence. English auctioneer G.E. Joseph from Somerset became a founder of the Frontier Agricultural and Commercial Bank in 1847. He never did provide credit to anyone from the Cut River Settlement, an act that was to irk the Khoisan. Despite capital being difficult to come by, the settlement did grow from 900 people in 1830 to 4,872 in 1845, including 60 English settlers. Quite an interesting group of people, you'd say, particularly for the period. The Gonatqua, who settled along a stretch of river, the Blinkfarter, were cattle breeders rather than soil cultivators, more nomadic than the other groups. And they employed Amamfengu refugees, even Kunukwebe and some Amamtembu men as their herders too. By 1845, there were more than 200 Amamfengu living near the town of Phillipton. By the mid-19th century, the Cut River settlement had become the dumping ground for people dispossessed in other parts of the colony. As its population increased, its actual area contracted. No formal perimeter had been mapped, and only 100 titles had been issued by a really slow-moving colonial surveyor's department. Neighbouring English and Boer farmers didn't like them one little bit, and there had been a constant public relations campaign by journalists like Robert Godlinton against the Cut River settlement. The semi-feudal organisation of the settlement was hostile to the methods of British business. Godlinton wrote that it tended towards the separation of labour from capital, with fatal results, he intoned, which could be seen, he said, in places like Ireland. What was required, he wrote, was a vagrancy law. After the Seventh Frontier War, the Cut River people were on their last legs. The drought ravaged them, and now they were facing something even more odious, a vicious little technocrat. A major fire ripped through one of the villages in the Cut River Valley, and at Elan's Post, hundreds of sheep and cattle died of starvation. 80 of the settlement's wagons stood idle, the horses died, and government rations were handed out. Then another fire destroyed 90 more homes. So by May 1847, Governor Sir Henry Pottinger appointed a bankrupt farmer and a man who was known as a great hater of the Khoi Khoi to oversee the Khoi Khoi at the Cut River settlement. Thomas Jarvis Biddulph was appointed magistrate, and immediately there were issues. Andre Stockenstrom, for example, said Biddulph's moral character could not bear scrutiny. And the new magistrate launched into a series of verbal and physical attacks on the Khoi Khoi living along the Cut River and Blinkwater. He called them a lazy set of paupers and said that they would be better served working as labourers for the English settlers and the Boers. Just to reinforce his view, Biddulph pulled a tax stunt, increasing their tax from 18 pence to 6 shillings, from 18 cents to 60 cents. How about that for a tax hike? That's 43%. If you try that these days, the scratching sound of matches would be heard across South Africa. Biddulph's tax hike was designed to force the Khoi Khoi from the settlement and into the towns and onto the settlers' farms as labourers. The ravages of drought and the fires had convinced the authorities that the settlement was unable to sustain itself, so it all seemed to add up, unless you were a resident of the Cut River settlement. Pottinger then ordered 400 men to be drafted in from the settlement to help him fight the Amakosa, and the former Hong Kong governor began a systematic campaign. It was going to last for 5 years, and it would destroy the Cut River coloured settlement. He wouldn't see the end of that, because Pottinger would only live in South Africa for 10 months. Because of the overcrowding of the settlement and the protracted drought, there was no doubt that the people faced risk, but the analysis that the settlement was a waste of time was prejudiced, and Andre Stockenstrom warned about this analysis. Robert Godlinton railed in his editorials about the overcrowding and the idleness of the people of the valley. He was also of the opinion that they would make excellent labour for the English farmers and the Boers. This historic site didn't have long to go before it would be eviscerated by colonial jealousy. Even the former supporters, the missionaries, appeared to lose faith. One of the most ardent was Henry Calderwood. His idealism had evaporated. Living on the frontier had shattered his liberal attitudes, and now he seemed to swap one obsession for another. Where previously he'd obsessed about the Amakosa souls, now he obsessed about how he could assert executive power over the very same people. Calderwood began writing tomes about punishing the chiefs without charge, ceaselessly zealous in his alarming new philosophy. His real target was Ngqika Chief Sandile. He began to conspire against the Xhosa regent, believing his seizure along with the three other minor chiefs with him would benefit the Eastern Cape. At a conference of chiefs on the 23rd of April 1847, Calderwood became furious at Sandile, who was his usual calm self in the face of an Englishman's self-righteousness. Sandile told Calderwood that he was aware that the Englishman hadn't sent the Amaxhosa chief's notes of peace to the new governor Pottinger, that Calderwood basically was out to get him. Calderwood stopped the conference on the spot and ordered Sandile to apologize, which he did after his counselors advised him to do so. The Amaxhosa chief and his advisers understood what this odious little technocrat was trying to do. They managed to mask their true feelings. So, placate the bloke, he, like many others, would probably leave at some point. Things came to a head, though, in June 1847, when Calderwood was called in to deal with the theft of 14 goats stolen from the Amamfengu living in the Cut River settlement. Sandile was blamed, and after denying knowledge, miraculously he found 12 of the goats and sent them to Calderwood, saying they were found wandering in the veld. Sandile offered to search for the culprit if Calderwood wanted him to. No, said Calderwood, this was a very, very serious crime, one that the governor should hear about. And so Calderwood wrote to Pottinger, proposing they seize the Amaxhosa chief to humble him. And the governor agreed. Pottinger was the new governor on the block and trusted Calderwood. Perhaps he should have thought about that a little more clearly, because it is often the middle managers who cause the biggest headaches for any organization. Ask HR about that. Yeah, was the former governor of Hong Kong, Sir Henry Pottinger, a high functionary of the empire, of the mighty East India Company, a diplomat extraordinaire to China, who was allowing himself to use a small herd of goats as pretext to resume hostilities against Sandile and the Ngqika Amaxhosa. Pottinger sent 150 soldiers to help Calderwood seize Sandile and then advised him to strike the Amaxhosa chief at 3 a.m. The striking was a complete failure. Sandile escaped, and once more the war fires were lit along the Amatola mountainsides. This wasn't a complete return to war, but a notice that the British were up to the old tricks. One of the things that had driven Pottinger up the wall was the fact that the Amanika had continued to insist that they were at peace without admitting that they had been defeated, and by Sandile's refusal to resume full negotiations. On the 7th of August 1847, Sandile had been formally declared a rebel. Then the whole situation worsened and fast. Pottinger resorted to proclaiming that the Amamfengu, the Boers, and the Khoi Khoi, who fought with his regular soldiers, could seize whatever they liked from the Amaxhosa. The full-scale invasion of the Amatolas began again on the 29th of September 1847, whereupon every grain pit was emptied and every single animal seized, every hut burnt. The strategy achieved its desired effect, and Amaxhosa women and children began dying within a month. Sandile was in an invidious position, and what followed was another blight on the British Empire's dealings with the Amaxhosa. If you remember, Hintsa had been pursued to his death, and Sandile made the mistake of trusting the honour of a British soldier. He met with Deputy Assistant Quartermaster General John Jarvis Bissett, who'd actually been part of the section that had killed Hintsa all those years ago. Bissett promised that Sandile would be part of peace negotiations if he accompanied the Quartermaster General to Grahamstown. Instead, when the Amaxhosa chief reached the town on the 25th of October, he was thrown into prison. Maqoma had also been picked up, so now the Amararabi were unable to continue their war or their version of the peace because their two most important leaders were in jail. It allowed Pottinger to concentrate on the other chiefs, including Patu of the Qunuqwebe and Sarili, the paramount chief of the entire Amaxhosa who lived across the Kai River. A merciless operation was conducted, so much so that the army's chief medical officer, Sir John Hall, left us with his views to read in his journal. Hall was contemptuous, particularly of Colonel Henry Somerset.
This system of cattle stealing and hut burning is a disgrace to the age we live in, and if the savages retaliate hereafter, no one can blame them.
Hall warned.
After the example of pillage and destruction that has been sent them by the army on the present occasion.
General Sir George Berkeley's own adjutant, Captain Charles Francis Seymour, made a somewhat dubious name for himself, for he had a weakness for shooting Amakosa women and children.
The service is inglorious, wrote Hall, and all are anxious to get away from it.
Meanwhile, Sandile sat in a locked room in Grahamstown, pondering his fate. It was only when he was ushered into the room with its single bed and mattress of straw that he realized he had been lied to and was now a prisoner. Throughout the rest of his life, he was to regard the British process of getting him into that room as an act of gross deceit and treachery. Sir Henry Pottinger never met Sandile. It's also unclear about what the governor was planning to do with the Amakosa chief. Perhaps Robben Island awaited. What was clear, however, was that the manner of Sandile's arrest had become an embarrassment. Sandile denied he had surrendered. He had walked in as a chief who wanted to negotiate with an empire. His charge of treachery made Pottinger blanch. A flurry of stories flowed. Everyone needed to protect their reputation, starting with Pottinger himself.
I have now strong reasons for believing that Sandile was, previous to his surrender, encouraged to give himself up for promises to which I never intimated, of which I was totally ignorant,
he wrote. Still, Sandile wasn't set free in spite of overwhelming evidence of treachery. Instead, he sat in this little room, drinking wine, becoming bitter and angry. He swore he would never trust the word of a white man again. The whole sorry saga was going to have quite an interesting end. For Pottinger, barely a few months in the job of governor of the Cape, he just heard that he was being reappointed commander of the Madras forces in India. That was the job he had hoped for when he was assigned to the Cape for a cool £10,000 a year. And the new governor was on his way already. And the new governor was none other than Sir Harry Smith, Lieutenant General Harry Smith, the Baronet of Aliwal, mind you. More about what happened next in episode 170. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. That helps elevate the visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about this episode. You can contact me from there too. Until next, Salagatli.